AI is your gym, right? AI is where you build your negotiation muscle. It's not where you're actually using it live in a negotiation, right? And I get this question all the time. Well, how am I going to use AI in this negotiation? Or how am I going to get AI to negotiate for me? AI is not going to negotiate for you, at least not now, right?
But if you're not adaptable and can think on the fly, you can miss some opportunities, or you can shoot yourself in the foot and negotiate your way out of a deal. You've already got a deal. You want to negotiate new terms, or you want to negotiate an extension. If you're too hard about it, you can negotiate your way out of a deal.
We actually got to a place where nobody even thought was possible, like when we walked into this room, right? So there's negotiations like that. There's negotiations on the other spectrum where it's like both parties, to your point, are not like, they don't even think, oh, I could have got a bit more. They actually think, is this even right? You know, like, yes, we agreed to it, but...
You're at the right place. My guest today takes negotiation very, very seriously. But that doesn't mean he's not a lacquer guy. He is the lacquer guy himself, Mr. Guy Ellis. As co-founder of the Lacquer Network, global entrepreneur, investor, private equity fund leader, and now author of the brand new book, The Negotiation Code, he has spent many years helping people and businesses negotiate smarter. Today, we will learn how to win well, lose gracefully, unlock opportunities, and even use AI to sharpen your negotiation edge. Welcome, Guy, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, John. Really a privilege to be here, and I appreciate you having me on the Right Place podcast today, and excited to dive into your questions and just explore a few things together.
No, thanks so much, Guy. I've really, really been looking forward to this conversation for a while now, and grateful for the opportunity. Guy, let's dive straight in. People have been negotiating since Adam and Eve, who ended up losing to the snake and getting kicked out of their garden estate. Before we get too deep into the book and negotiation itself, can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book and where it comes from?
Yeah, absolutely, John. Thanks so much for asking. Just, you know, having the childhood I had, you know, I lost my dad when I was 7 and, you know, landed up having to negotiate for myself a lot of the time. You know, when other kids, for example, had... you know, at least at my school, had parents negotiating with teachers and with sports coaches and things like that. You know, I kind of like had to do most of it myself, and you know, just learned what didn't work, and then tried to start finding what did work, and that's kind of like where my negotiations started. And then, really, in my early 20s, you know, I really kind of dived into it a lot deeper, trying to understand what gets deals done, you know, what makes people want to work together, what makes people not want to work together, etc. And then the evolution from there is, you know, just seeing so many deals all over the world and supporting people in their deals and trying to help mediate certain things sometimes, that I started realizing, firstly, what is a negotiation and what isn't. You know, sometimes it's actually litigation, it's not negotiation. So that's the first thing that people have to realize. But one step beyond that, you know, what's very important is well, how do we make this a win-win? How do we build the relationship, right? And what happened was, I had people that I deeply respected turn around and say, hey, Guy, you know, you need to write a book on this, you know, because I'd walk them through a negotiation, or I'd be on, you know, on their side in a negotiation and try to give them like pointers and tips and stuff. And they turn around often and they'd be like, don't know what you did, don't know what happened, but somehow the deal's done, you know? And they said, like, you need to write a book on this, because it's like some hocus pocus magic, you know, that gets stuff done. And that's when I came up with the concept of, the best negotiations happen when the other side doesn't even realize they're in a negotiation. You know, and that's like the kind of gist of it. And yeah, based on these people that I really admired telling me to write a book, I just heard it often enough that I decided to write a book.
Excellent, Guy. No, congratulations and well done for following through. I've read the book myself, and we've been handing it out to a lot of the Lacquer Network members. It was the book that was given out at the launch as well. And I think because it's coming from a personal space, and it's also advice that you've been using, it's not just a rehash of what we've heard before. It's actually stuff that you've used in negotiation, that you've been in with the different businesses and the boards that you're involved in. And I'm interested in what you said there about a win-win, because a friend of mine recently told me that the best deal is one where both parties feel like they should have gotten more. So rather than they both feeling like they won, they're a little bit uncomfortable. Okay, we could have squeezed this, or we could have got an extra percent there. What do you make of that?
It's a great question, John. So there's all different types of deals, obviously, right? So every deal is different. You get deals where everyone walks away and they're like, that was phenomenal. We actually got to a place where nobody even thought was possible, like when we walked into this room, right? So there's negotiations like that. There's negotiations on the other spectrum where it's like both parties, to your point, are not like, they don't even think, oh, I could have got a bit more. They actually think, is this even right? You know, like, yes, we agreed to it, but like, you know, they might have big doubts and things like that, right? And then there's somewhere in the middle, like you mentioned, where both sides are a little bit uncomfortable. They said, yeah, could have pushed harder, could have maybe got it for like a little bit less or a little bit, you know, sold it for a bit more, etc. But ultimately, the deal was done, you know, and I always say that getting to a deal is more important than winning, you know, like if you look at the there's two ways to look at it, right? If you look at the deals that are lost within anyone's lifetime, right? Like calculate the value of that, right? The value of losing the deal and compounding that over a lifetime is massive, right? Or not losing, just not getting a deal done, right? In where you could have actually got a deal done. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you were just 1% better in your negotiation skills, could you have got an extra 0.5%, 1%, 2%, you know, and maybe you could have even given the other side an extra 5% to get your 1%, right? It's not necessarily lose-lose, it's win-win, right? That's why I use the term win-win. Using different techniques, you could have actually made it better for everyone. You could have made the pie bigger. And that's the question. How do you make the pie bigger, right? Not just take more of the pie, but how do you make it bigger? And that's really the key point. So focusing on those different ways of thinking and trying to make the pie bigger all the time, I think is key versus, well, how could I extract an extra percent for myself, right? It's how do we make this better for everyone? And I think that's the mentality that is key. And getting back to your question, that's probably the best way to answer it is how do you make the pie bigger versus, well, how do I, you know, I felt a little bit uncomfortable. I could have got like the pie still the same size and maybe I could have like got an extra 1 or 2% out of it.
I absolutely love that response, Guy, because I think if you've done your homework and you really want to get a deal done with these people, then you're going to try everything possible to get it done. Because if you don't get it done, your competitors are going to swoop in or somebody else is going to steal the deal. And in 5 years' time, you're just going to think back and like, damn it, man, we just had to get an extra percent, or we just had to offer this, or we just had to back down on this. And I think that leads quite nicely into my next question, which is in the book, you've got 10 strategies from number one, which is practice your people skills, all the way to number 10, which is create your negotiating grid. But six of those 10 steps in the book happen before you even get to the negotiation table. So you're not always just focused on actually in the negotiation. You're talking more about what do you do before the time. So does this mean that the person who is best prepared is sometimes already the winner?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, going back to your, you know, what you mentioned, practice your people skills, John, if you look at that and you say, well, let me use an example, right? Like your best friend, right? You really want sushi this Saturday night and you've got plans with them and they've booked at an Italian restaurant, right? You've got like, this is a guy you grew up with. He's your friend, right? Your best mate, right? How easy is it for you to negotiate that you want sushi versus Italian from your best mate, right? You've got that relationship. It's not a hard negotiation, right? Versus if you're you know, in a totally different situation and you're meeting someone new, right? And you're meeting at their offices, but you want them to go to a neutral place, for example, right? Or you want them to come to your offices. How do you negotiate that? It's a total different thought process, a total different way of going about it, right? So if you start right at the beginning in terms of like existing relationships versus new relationships, right? That takes years to create, right? I mean, it might be your best mate since you were three, right? So like you can't manufacture that, right? That's just history. So, you know, to your point, so much happens before you even get to the table. And there's some things that we can't recreate, which is a 40-year relationship or a 35-year relationship. And there's some things we can prepare for, which is planning and preparation, you know, which is that the one chapter in the book. So, and a whole bunch of different other techniques. So that's really it. Is you mentioned when we were speaking about your previous question about homework, doing your homework, you know, and that's really it. So the better prepared you are, the better the outcomes are almost all the time.
I think, Guy, maybe give us one of your favorite examples in terms of the preparedness for getting to the negotiation room.
So without giving out names, one of the top negotiation professors in the world, you know, I was very fortunate to learn with him and learn from him. And he was telling the story of himself, right, being approached for a board role on a Fortune 100 company in the United States. And he was one of, say, four, I think, candidates that were approached for the role. And he went, because it was a listed company, he went and he actually downloaded the SEC filings, you know, and all the documentation and printed it out, right? And sat and read it with a highlighter and flags. And when he went into the interview, he took it with him and he put it on the table, right? And he said he was amazed that nobody else had done that. You know, the other candidates that were being interviewed hadn't done that. And they didn't even go into the SEC filings or anything like that. You know, they didn't like dive into the detail or questioning him on it. But just the fact that he had done it and showed that level of planning and preparation, he was just light years ahead of the other candidates, just from a perception perspective, if nothing else. And lo and behold, he got the role.
Oh, that's a really cool example. And also then taking your preparation with you to demonstrate, look, I've done the work. I'm so confident I'm going to nail this because I've done the work. I'm ready. I'm happy. I'm delighted. I'm excited to take this part. That shows a lot of guts, and it also shows that you care. You're not just winging it. You're not just there because of your reputation or because of what your degree says or your marks or something. Like, you've actually done the work, and I think that shows a lot of character as well. And those are the people that will get far in life because they've gone that little bit extra and they've showed up with intent. And it just shows, like, negotiation isn't just for getting deals done. It's for negotiating a better pay rise, a better position, secondment, or that dream job of yours. Let's talk about what you say and what you don't say in negotiations, Guy, because you can say a lot and oftentimes you can almost say too much. But how does a negotiation code, the book that you wrote, address the power of silence or what's left unsaid?
It's a really, really great question, John. And I love the subject, you know, and in some of my teaching that I do, actually use it a lot. And that's a great example of it, right? How did you feel when I did that? Did you panic a little bit? Did you think, is his video frozen? Is his mic not working? Like,
wasn't working.
Yeah, right. So, but it made you flustered, right? Now you're flustered. Now your heart rate's going. This is a physical reaction that's happening to you literally in real time, right? Now, if this was a negotiation, how would you feel, right? You're automatically on the back foot. It's like when the Springboks are in their 22 defending and Beauden Barrett gives a little chip kick over the kind of defensive line, you know, everyone's scramble defense, you know, and it's panic. So it's like, that's a great example of a pause, right? That you can use that it really just works exceptionally well. You know, puts the other side on the back foot, you know, and it's not a great technique to use, but it works, right? And it's not necessarily like guerrilla tactics. It's actually just like a really good tactic to sit with your thoughts and kind of like think, you know, before you respond. And that's, you know, going back to your question about, well, what do you say, what do you don't say? There's obvious things that you don't say in negotiation, like, this is my last offer, take it or leave it, you know, or putting people under pressure and, you know, like, I need an answer within the next 30 minutes or the deal's off. You know, that's not the right way to negotiate, right? But also knowing what to share and what not to share and when to share it is super important. And that's why if you go into the negotiating grid, right? And you go into the UNO matrix, which is also in my book. It shows you what to share and when and how to share it. And that's super important. Like, for example, you know, just starting with concession opportunities, right? Concessions are things that are, or call it deal points, that are very important to the other side, but not so important to you. So they're easy for you to give. And when you start with concessions, show the other side that you're flexible and that you're here to negotiate. And it's psychologically good for them to know that they're receiving first, right? But then you immediately go into gain points. Gain points are essentially deal points that are very important to you and you know or estimate are less important to the other side. So it's hopefully easy for them to give, right? So you're giving and you're taking, you know, but you're not starting off with items that are in the fracture zone, you know, which are, you know, like contentious issues and things like that. So yeah, it's knowing what to share, when and how, which is super important. And to your question, knowing what not to say as well.
Mm. And I think, Guy, that all comes from experience as well. I mean, in the beginning, when you first negotiate your first deal, or your first pay rise or things like that, you can be very nervous. You can be very overwhelmed by the situation and you want to get it done, but you also want to almost get it done as fast as possible, because the longer you sit there, almost like you assume the worst it's going to get for you. Like, the longer I sit in this chair, the less my pay rise is going to be, the more the deal is going to be in the other person's favor. And I like what you said there about concessions, and you talk a lot about concessions in your book, but then you also introduce an acronym to us, which is BSO, Best Secondary Option, which is the alternative baseline agreement or the least acceptable option that you could fall back on if things go a bit sideways. You tell us that you need to define this, refine this, and protect it, but then also try and find out what is the other party's BSO. When I first read this, I was like, oh, that's a lot of work to do for a plan B. Shouldn't we just be focusing on plan A and put all of our efforts into that? What is your view on that?
It's a great question, John. So plan A and plan B are the same plan, right? That's important to say up front, right? What your BSO is your BSO is your reserve point, right? That's your point where you know you can get a better deal elsewhere. So, for example, if we're negotiating something and I'm pushing too much or I can't give you what you want or what you can get elsewhere, right? That's your walkaway point. That's your reserve point. So that's when you know going into the negotiation, if Guy won't sell this to me for 10 Rand, I'm walking away because I know I can get it for 10 Rand elsewhere, kind of thing, right? So, or lower than 10 Rand elsewhere. So that's the walkaway point. That's what you use your BSO for. Right now, completely independent to that is the other side's BSO and your estimate of their BSO. And there's ways to calculate it, right? Or to estimate it. And their BSO is what you base your goal on, right? And again, totally independent to your BSO, right? So what is your goal? You know, how are you going to create an ambitious goal based on their BSO, right? So those are the two things. So this is there's only one plan. It's plan A, right? But in plan A and knowing what you want to get in plan A, it's very important to remember that you also need to know when to walk away from a deal and how much you can get out of a deal, right? So let's say, hypothetically speaking, like you think you can get this for 12 Rand, right? And that's going to be your purchase price. But you actually estimate that these people produce it for 50 cents all in, right? Call it like distribution costs, everything. Like that's their landed cost that they can, if they want to break even, they sell it to you at 50 cents, right? Why would you offer them 10 Rand or 9 Rand? You know, like wouldn't you start at 1 or 50 cents, right? Or depending on how much stock they have and how well sales are going, maybe 25 cents, right? So that's why estimating the BSO of the other side is so important, because your goal is based on that. But if they want to sell it to you at 15 Rand and you know you can get it, worst case, at Pick and Pay for 12 Rand, you know, why are you going to pay 15 when you can buy it for 12? So that's a very simple, like, you know, description of BSO and why best secondary options are so important to yours and the other sides, or the estimate of the other sides, and just understanding that. And going back to like my earlier comment about, well, what's a negotiation and what's potentially litigation, you never want to get into litigation, right? You want to have mediation, but you also need to know what is your walkaway point, right? What is that? What is your best secondary option here, right? What is the original agreement? What was the original contract? You know, things like that. And you always want to know that, you know, that is the best secondary option, but you still have to enforce that, right? So in mediations, for example, like, yes, that's what the contract says, but ultimately, like, who's going to enforce it? You want to go to court? You want to stay in court for 5 years? You want to spend all the legal fees, et cetera? So you actually have to take the contract point and deduct all those things, and that's your best secondary option, right? So if someone comes to you with that, you know, what is your reserve point there? But on the other side of things, what is their BSO and what is your ambitious goal based on that, right? And when you start looking at all these nuances, it's not just, you don't just take things on face value. You've got to like look into them a lot deeper, because we're human beings, right? And for a long time, and the research is out now, that people thought we were rational beings that were sometimes emotional. But it's proven now that we are emotional beings that can sometimes be rational, right? So we've got to constantly remember that we're dealing with emotions and human beings here, and it's not black or white.
No, 100%. I love that example that you made there. And I mean, it relates to your adaptability as well. In a negotiation, things don't always go according to plan. You've done all of your homework. You've got the BSO. You've done your research and everything. But if you're not adaptable and can think on the fly, you can miss some opportunities, or you can shoot yourself in the foot and negotiate your way out of a deal. You've already got a deal. You want to negotiate new terms, or you want to negotiate an extension. If you're too hard about it, you can negotiate your way out of a deal. And also in the book, you speak about three Qs, IQ, SQ, EQ, and AQ, or the adaptability quotient, which is the measure of a person's response to change. Guy, in an AI-driven world, change is happening by the hour and sometimes even by the minute. How do we prepare adequately to negotiate when things can change so fast, where yesterday everything was fine, the deal was fine, but now new technologies come out, or Elon Musk said something, or Donald Trump changed this? How do we manage that landscape in the negotiation world?
A great question, John. Obviously, there's always going to be macro factors that are happening, right, that we have zero control over. So we just have to, you know, take that into account live, right? So talking about BSO, for example, your BSO is a living, breathing thing, right? Like, you can be right in the middle of a negotiation and someone comes on TV or on Twitter or, you know, X or LinkedIn and says something. Now it changes the whole dynamic. You know, suddenly prices have shot up or shot down, you know, and the whole landscape has changed. That affects your BSO live. So where your reservation point was X, it might change, right? Whether your goal was Y, it might change, right? So you've got to be able to be flexible on, you know, on your feet and adaptable in those scenarios. And one of the big things that out of the book as well is the beacons framework, right? And one of the core beacons is adaptability, right? So yes, you mentioned like an adaptability quotient, which is, it's an intelligence. It's one of our intelligences, right? And it's so important. It's like, you know, it's the theory of evolution, right? And we have to be adaptable. But also being adaptable in the moment, you know, like the Beacons framework was born out of the question that Aram Denigian asked me, well, how do you negotiate upwards when you're in a multi-hundred million or multi-billion dollar business and you're reporting up to the CEO or the board, right? And how do you go about actually negotiating in that when you don't hold the power, so to speak, right? And how do you negotiate in that? And adaptability is one of the most important things with, you know, perseverance and things like that, that you can actually keep going in spite of the fact that you might not get what you want immediately. But there's also ways to be adaptable, right? And things to use, like, for example, creating a circle of influence. You know, most people just go and negotiate alone. Very few people think about, well, how do I create a circle of influence in this negotiation, right? And in that example, well, let's say that you're the chief operating officer of a business, and you're trying to negotiate with the board or with the CEO to get a new project signed off or something, right? Well, going in alone doesn't work so well, right? But imagine you had to get the CFO, a board member, you know, a few other people, you know, the chief technology officer, get them all on that same team, make it their idea, not yours, right? And go negotiate as a united front to get that across the line. It's a totally different negotiation than just you. So there's lots of different ways to be adaptable and to think on your feet and be flexible in the moment to make sure that the deal doesn't fall apart and you still get things going and over the line.
Mm. No, I love that explanation. And I think that's really valuable advice to the business owner, that be adaptable. Like, you might have gone it alone before and had limited success, but if someone's important to you, get some people on your side before you get into the room. And you can even use AI nowadays to test some of these theories. And just thinking back to your book in chapter 4, you talk about using AI iterative prompting and testing strategies. Guy, how far can you go with AI before it clashes with the human element that is so key to negotiation? We can't outsource everything to AI, and AI is not going to be with us in the room or around the boardroom table, right?
Totally, John. So it can be today. You know, if you have your laptop open and you're prompting while you're going, but I wouldn't advise it. It's a great question, right? And my answer is, AI is your gym, right? AI is where you build your negotiation muscle. It's not where you're actually using it live in a negotiation, right? And I get this question all the time. Well, how am I going to use AI in this negotiation? Or how am I going to get AI to negotiate for me? AI is not going to negotiate for you, at least not now, right? So really, what you want to do is you want to use it as a training ground, right? So you want to prompt it correctly, and you want to give it the facts. You want to give it a persona. You want to basically create that entire picture for AI, right? And then you want to start prompting it with questions like, you know, give me obvious and non-obvious pushback. Or, you know, what am I missing here? What am I not thinking about? You know, what could be a macro trend that is affecting this that I haven't picked up in my research, you know, in my planning and preparation? Have I missed anything in the news? You know, am I missing anything about the industry? You know, and then you go into the actual negotiation, right? And questions and about the deal and the concessions and the gain points and the fracture zone items and neutral ground items. And, you know, you use AI as your gym, right? So by the time it's practicing, right? So you've got like something with infinite knowledge that you're giving the context of your negotiation to, and you're training, right? So just like if I said to you, hey, John, how important is this negotiation to you, right? It can potentially change your life, right? Let's say, okay. Now, if you were training for Ironman, right, would you just like go to the gym once or twice, you know, maybe jump on your bike and ride it around the block, make sure the wheels are still, you know, working and grease the chain, maybe jump in a pool, like, you know, your 10 meter long pool and do like 5 laps and think, okay, I'm ready to rock. I've done a bit of planning and preparation, right? It's the same thing, you know. Or would you go train for months and plan and prepare and try get better? And what am I missing? And is my nutrition dialed in? And what's my nutrition on the day? And you know, run through the entire thing. But by the time you get to the Ironman, it's just like another training session, right? Like there's nothing that it can throw at you. Like it might be windy, it might be raining, it might be choppy, the water. It, you know, you might get a blister on the run, like. But it's all happened to you, right? And you've seen it and you've dealt with it. So it's just become second nature. So that's how you want to use AI is your training partner. That's really what it's there for, right? It's not going to replace you in a negotiation.
No, excellent, guys. I think that's a wonderful breakdown that you can do a lot of work yourself, then engage AI to sharpen that, to sharpen your pencil, to sharpen your response, and to try and anticipate what could come up in the meeting. And I really think the teams can benefit a lot from doing that and make it part of your regular negotiation preparation, that you'd schedule some extra time with AI and you get used to it and you get cleverer with the prompts, and it's going to pay dividends in the long run. And talking about paying dividends in the long run, Guy, I don't know what you've done, but you've definitely made a name for yourself, in America. And over the last couple of months, you've had the privilege of talking and lecturing at Harvard University, which is absolutely incredible. And your name has been listed alongside Mark Cuban and Ted Sarandos. There's so many questions I could ask you about that experience, but mainly, Guy, you're at one of the most famous universities in the world, and you're lecturing and you're talking and teaching. But what did you learn during this whole process, maybe about negotiation or about yourself?
Thanks, John. I really appreciate your kind words. And very, very surreal, just even talking about it. And I'm just very privileged. I feel very privileged to have been a part of it. Geez, John, you learn stuff every day. Hey, you know, like these questions that that some of the students ask really keep you on your toes. You know, they make you sharper in thinking about negotiations, right? They give you examples, maybe live examples that they're going through that they throw your way, and now suddenly, you know, now you're in their shoes, and now you're negotiating for them, and you're trying to think, well, you know, if I was in that position, how would I do things differently? It's almost like getting live case studies thrown at you. So I suppose the biggest lesson that came out of that is that there's no such thing as a negotiation expert. You know, I think it's really about how much you practice, right? And how much you work that muscle on an ongoing basis. And that's, you know, I suppose the big learning is that, you know, I definitely don't see myself as an expert. I see myself as a practitioner, you know, and someone who likes practicing negotiations and trying to find opportunities that I can practice negotiations, rather than, you know, like an expert. And it's like a level playing ground, you know, like you're dealing with people that, you know, you have people that think they're terrible negotiators, but they're actually brilliant negotiators, and they didn't realize it. You know, so the magic comes from being open and having an open mind to learning from anyone, regardless of their background or experience.
Mm. No, amazing, Guy, and I mean to be a lifelong student as well, not just to, like you say, I'm the expert, I know everything. And I found in my own work and coaching people on networking and how to connect better, I've learned the most. From the teaching, you learn so much because you see what people are dealing with. You understand their frustrations. You hear their stories. And there's nothing like having to think on your feet in the moment. I mean, you have to dig deep into your brain cells and go and pull out some amazing answers and solutions. And Guy, before we get into some more personal questions, I just want to have one last question about the book. In chapter 5, it's which is Craft a Unique Value Proposition. And on page 97, to be exact, you talk about network advantage. And my eyes lit up when I read this. I love this paragraph. Immediately thought about people who brag about their contact list. But it's just a list of people that they know. They don't really have relationships with this, right? And then I was thinking also, like, we need to look beyond the deal on the paper and sometimes think about, okay, who's in the room here? Who else do these people know? Who else are they connected to? What else can they bring to the table? Maybe later along in the relationship. And then I also thought about, okay, but look at these amazing shows, like talking about Mark Cuban, like we did earlier, like Shark Tank and Dragon's Den, where business owners pitch their business or idea to five dragons with the hope of getting a deal done. But oftentimes I found myself like screaming at the screen and said, dude, just take the deal. You don't know who you're dealing with. Like Stephen Barter's going to invest in you, or Mark Cuban's going to invest in you. He knows other billionaires. He's going to open so many doors for you, and you're haggling over 1% of a silly sock idea or something like that. This network advantage thing, I just don't think people often understand what it's about, because they're so close-minded. They're like, can't give Mark Cuban an extra 5%, or I can't give him $100,000 or something. But the bigger picture is, further down the line, after working 2 or 3 years with Mark Cuban, that investment of that extra 1% or $100,000 here or there is going to have paid off in dividends because of the people you would have connected with. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about network advantage and maybe share an example that you've personally been involved in?
Absolutely, John. Thanks so much for bringing it up. You know, I think, you know, I'm passionate about this, and One clarification I have to make quickly for anyone that's buying the final version of the book: the page number is going to be different. But but back to your question, John. I mean, so many thoughts, right? Like people have told me so often, and people I work with now, like today, right? Like they tell me, you play a lot of this long game, Guy. Like, you know, like we need results now. You know, like you know, kind of thing. And absolutely, and totally on the same page and agree, And the thing to remember is that when you create value for someone else, right, without an agenda, you're building not just a contact list, you're building a network, right? You're building this advantage because people like you, you know, and you potentially change people's lives through introductions and things like that, right? So always remembering what value actually is. And in my teaching, I actually spend a little bit of time on value and what is value, right? And if you look at value, people say, well, I've got a lot of value to add here, right? Well, what is value? What is this value that you have to add? Like, tell me about it, right? And very often you'll see that the value, so to speak, that the person has is actually not what the company or person needs, right? So how I define value is what is that other side or person's or business's most pressing business or personal need? And what do you have that can fill that need? That's value, right? So ultimately, if you can create value for people over time, right, you're not just creating a contact list, you're creating a network, right? And you're creating value that actually means something. And when you need to pick up the phone for anything, right, people want to help you, right? And it's not that you're creating the value for that or doing anything to help someone else with an agenda. It's got nothing to do with that, right? It's just what should be done in networking, right? Specifically talking about networking. That is, in my opinion, the best way to network is not just to like small talk and hi, John, I'm Guy, like let's swap details and like see you someday, right? It's actually being curious. I think that's one of the biggest lessons is actually being curious and understanding who is this person? What motivates them? What are they, you know, what keeps them up at night? What do they need now, right? Personally, professionally, right? And everyone needs something, right? You could be talking to your point, a billionaire. You could be talking to someone who just finished high school. Like everyone has something that they need, right? And very often you or someone you know can fulfill that need and add value. So that's like really what it is. And one of the terms that I use, which is something that something I focus on personally, is this concept that I came up with called expansion through connection. So how do we expand the pie, going to what we were talking about earlier, right? Through connecting people. So it's a fancy way of saying, like, how do you just get the right people around the table, right? And expand the pie that way. I know where you're going with this, but that's like a great segue into, yeah, like networking and how important it is in negotiations. And back to the point that we were speaking about earlier in building the relationships over time, right? The best negotiations happen when the other side doesn't even realize they're in a negotiation. And why? Because you've built this relationship with them over time that they don't see it as a negotiation, right? You've added value in each other's lives. And when you ask them for something, it's not a big thing for them. It's not a negotiation. It just happens, you know, freely.
Awesome, Guy. No, thanks for indulging me on that networking question. I really appreciate your response there. And carrying on with that, this expansion through connection, you're one of the co-founders, the original four co-founders of the Lacquer Network, along with Nick and Rania and Madeline. Can you tell me about that, the background of them approaching you to join the founders team? What was your first reaction? And what were those feelings and maybe the excitement levels like when you first heard about the concept of the Lacquer Network?
I love it, John. And I don't think many people know the story, but I'll give you the real background, which is kind of what happened. So I was in Mauritius a few years ago, and Nick put out a post. I was connected with Nick and knew Nick, and Nick put out a post on LinkedIn about a South African business that was in the UK and was looking for something, right? And I reached out to Nick and I said, I might be able to help. It's an industry that I understand well. Happy to connect with them and just have a conversation, if nothing else. So Nick put me in touch with that person and I ended up having a conversation. I couldn't help, right, which I didn't like, but I went back to Nick and I said, like, so sorry, like, it's not within my wheelhouse, you know, but it was great to meet the person. Thanks so much for the intro. And Nick said to me, guy, you won't believe that I've had like over 100 people reach out about this post. You know, like South Africans just want to help South Africans. So, you know, and support South Africans. So I said, like tongue in cheek, I said, well, Nick, why don't you start a network? So we both like laughed it off, right? And he phoned me 2 weeks later and he said, guy, you know, I've been thinking about this. Like I actually want to put out a post on LinkedIn to see if I should start a network, right? Because it's just so much power and people are still messaging me and like from one post. So I said, well, go for it. Like put it out, you know, and see what people say. And he put out that post that went viral, right? That said, should we start a network that connects South Africans around the world? We didn't even have a name for it at the time. Nick and I were talking about the name like Ubuntu Network. And, you know, we had all names that we were exploring. And that post went viral. And then Nick and I tried to like do something with it over the next few months and put out a few. I had like zero LinkedIn followers, but Nick had quite a following. So he carried on posting about it every now and again, and it got more traction every time. But I couldn't run it, and I made that clear to Nick and he couldn't run it. And we had to make a decision to kind of like, we had this amazing concept that an idea that we had, but expansion through connection. How do we make the pie bigger? How do we bring in other people that can actually execute, who are the perfect people to actually go out and roll this out? So Nick had a relationship with Renier and met Renier and Madeline, and you know, because I wasn't in Cape Town, and they hit it off and decided that this was the team to get it done. And then I met Renier and Madeline and came up with the Lacquer Network just before Renier and Madeline joined. And then because of Renier and Madeline's background, we rebranded it as it is today with the cool colors and went through that whole branding exercise. And yeah, then just started rolling it out. And, you know, as you say, the rest is history. You know the story that happened in October, November last year when we had 200 people sign up just based on a silly concept of South Africans supporting South Africans all over the world, you know. And here we are today. We're on track to hit 450 members if Paul has his way with it by the end of the month.
No, absolutely amazing, guy. Thank you so much for sharing the background. And thanks for sticking with the concept. I often tell people that you never know what a great idea is until you've almost shared it with a couple of other people. You might reject the idea yourself, but sometimes we just need to share it with another person and have a conversation with Nick, with Renier, with Madeline, and like, guys, there's something here. This is absolutely worth a shot because we've had some viral posts. South Africans need help. We need help in our country. We need help abroad. We love working together. So kudos to you and the team for just going with it. And yeah, I mean, it's been an absolute fun ride so far. And what I tell people is 400 people can't be wrong. And we're going to hit 500. We're going to hit 1,000. We're going to hit a couple of thousand in a couple of years' time. People want to help. South Africans love helping each other. We come from this warm country where relationships are valued more than anything else. You can have no money in your pocket, but you can have family and friends around you supporting you and loving you and caring for you and opening up doors of opportunity for you. And that's just a South African way. And we don't have to explain it to anybody else. Other people can just see it and say, hey, man, these South Africans are up to something. They're up to something lacquer. And that for me has been wonderful to see so far in the journey with the Lacquer Network. So yeah, well done to you guys for sticking with it. And it's been an amazing opportunity for me to join the team as well. And I've loved every minute from it. I tell Renier and the team often, look, I've got 100% job satisfaction because it's so much fun. It's so lacquer to help people connect, so lacquer to be involved because it's such a South African thing. And this has really helped me find my right place. So yeah, always grateful for the opportunity.
Amazing, John. No, it's such a privilege to have you on the team, you know, and just the makeup of the team. I feel very, very grateful for everyone on the team. And there's just, I think we haven't even scratched the surface yet of what we can do together, you know, and South Africans really punch above their weight all over the world, right? From sport to business to, you know, everything, you know, we really do exceptionally well. And, you know, people have asked me, well, you left South Africa. Surely you don't love South Africa, or like you don't, you know, like the country. And that's not true at all. I love South Africa. I'm one of the most patriotic people that you'll find, you know, about South Africa. And South Africa is it's a feeling, right? South Africa is, it's not necessarily like, it's not necessarily a place. It's not owned by anyone, right? It's a feeling that we own within ourselves. And to your point, we have this shared, grit and resilience that we all grew up with, right? Regardless of our background. And we can say, how's it brew? And, you know, like regardless of background, like everyone gets it, you know, and we're a special bunch, and no one's ever come together to create a network to really support each other in a very intentional way, right? Obviously, there's lots of groups and people have got together, and there's all different ways that South Africans are connecting, but what we want to do is make it very intentional, and just really make a difference. I think ultimately that's the plan that we want to do is have a material difference on the trajectory of South Africa because the LACA network exists. That's ultimately the goal.
No, absolutely, Guy. I love the goal and I love the mantra of the how can I help you, and that says so much. And that says so much to the South Africans as well, that we're there to help first, and we'll figure out business and transactions and that type of stuff later. But let's build a LACA relationship. Let's help each other with introductions and connections and advice, and especially for those that want to scale out of Cape Town or out of Joburg and get to the UK, get to America, get to the Far East. There are amazing South Africans already there and doing it, who are part of the LACA network, and they're willing and able to help you. And that just says a lot about the spirit. And exactly like you said, like South Africa isn't a place, it's a feeling. It's that spirit that you carry with you. It's that pride. I'm a South African. People love hearing that you're a South African. You tell them, I'm from South Africa. They're like, oh my word, that's so crazy cool. Haven't met anybody there yet. People love having those types of conversations because of all the hardships that we've had to face and ups and downs and the history and the trauma that came with that. We've somehow managed to keep the lights on, well, barely, but we've somehow managed to keep doors open and schools running and things like that. And yeah, we're not a perfect place and there's still lots of challenges, but we keep trying. And even when we leave our shores, we carry on. We keep trying in the UK, keep trying in America. And during this transition, this building up of the LACA network, when this idea arose, you were in Mauritius and now you find yourself in Florida, in the USA for the last year or so. Tell me about that business environment and how it helps people be so successful there, because it definitely looks like the land of opportunity still, in spite of all of the current political chaos that Donald Trump has brought.
Yeah, John, the word to sum it up is scale, right? And this is as capitalist as you get, you know. People want to make money. They want to do business deals. That's the culture, right? And it's just the scale is ginormous. You know, like each state is huge, right? And if you've got a good concept that adds value to people's lives and you're fulfilling a pain point or a need, you can very quickly scale to $100+ million business. You know, it's not difficult when you've hit a pain point or fulfilled a real need in the market, right? So obviously it's not simple, otherwise everyone would be doing it, but it's the scale and the opportunity here, I think, is almost second to none in the world. And it's just a great place to be, you know, and to do business and to interact with people. And it's so funny, you know, South Africans are drawn to each other, you know, even here, you know, they want to do business together. They want to partner together and support each other.
Absolutely amazing, Guy. No, I wish you all the best that side. You're obviously doing really well, having made it all the way to Harvard University as well. Guy, I think we're gonna wrap it up there. As I said, I've always got more questions than time allows for it. Really enjoyed talking to you so much. And again, congratulations on the book. If people want to connect with you, if people want to chat a little bit more about negotiation, where's the best place to get hold of you?
Probably through LinkedIn, John. And I try reply to everyone, and yeah, I would love to connect on negotiations and and see how I can add value in people's lives.
Excellent, Guy. We're going to put that link down below. We're also going to put a link to where people can get their own copy of the negotiation code. I know the Lacquer Network team has still got a couple of copies of the special edition that was given at the Lacquer Network launch. So we'll still be handing out those in our in-person events as well. Guy, thank you so much. It's been an absolutely wonderful conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, please connect with Guy. Please get your own copy of the negotiation code. Remember to follow and subscribe to the Right Place podcast. Thank you, Guy. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And then we will see you next time at the Right Place. Cheers.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.